back then, it seemed more like I was just basically trying to defend myself and, you know, the reputations of the rest of the crew. But more and more lately, you know, along with the burden of all this, it, you know, dawns on me that a sense of responsibility about trying to make something good come of it.
Ladies and gentlemen!
I'm there under an assumed name because of the incredible interest. And we come out of the famous Barrows Neurological Institute after my brainwave scan, and we're in the parking lot, and somebody goes, "There he is!" And then they're chasing us, you know? You know, we went roller skating, and it was my first time out, so I fell down a lot. But it was the weirdest thing. Travis, he'd fall down and he'd get up and he'd keep skating again. It was the strangest thing to hear somebody tell about it. There was 20 people on the floor doing the same thing, you know. But, you know, since it was me, it had to be weird. You wouldn't believe how many people, probably one at each time I speak, who wants to get up and explain to me who they are, where they're from, what they meant, what their intentions were, and all that's well and good, except they're all different.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. Yes, at long last, we are closing the book on Season 7, and we are doing it once again in traditional historic fashion. Before we dive into the festivities, though, since I know I have the attention of all of the listeners, and that includes the folks who don't tune in to the end segment, just want to give a heads up on some stuff we have cooking. First of all, BOA Audio Season 8 is a go, and it is happening. You can expect it sometime in the fall, and I plan on starting taping the new episodes in September, and I have quite the list of eclectic and fascinating future guests. Additionally, stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook, because there you'll find out about BOA Live, our new live program, which will serve as your BOA audio hub until we launch Season 8. I've already got huge plans for that, so the party is not ending here with the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. We are just molting and rolling into another era of the program. The final thing I want to mention here at the beginning of the show before we get into the festivities, I know you can't wait. I know you've been waiting long enough. You want me to just hurry up and shut up, and I get that. But I got to plug and ask for donations here because it is the season finale. This is the 33rd episode of BOA Audio Season 7. It's been going on for over a year here. I couldn't even begin right now to list the guests you've heard over the last year, but some real classics. So it is time, I guess, to say to the folks who have been tuning in all this time, have not thrown some change into the bucket, please do so. Now is your time to say thanks for the last year of programming. Now is your chance to say thank you for Season 7 in its entirety. You can donate via PayPal at Banal of America or via our P.O. Box. You can find the address for that also at Banal of America, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. And as I say at the end of every program, no donation is too small and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Help us get into the black as we begin Season 8 and kick off BOA Live. I can tell you folks, the live program is going to cost me a little bit more than my usual budget, I guess you could say, for Benal of America. So any donations you can make would be greatly, greatly appreciated. Now that you've put up with all that, let's get cooking here on the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. In keeping with tradition, we are welcoming a legendary guest to the program here to help us close the book on the season. This season, the guest is alien abductee Travis Walton, who joins us for an in-depth discussion on his historic UFO encounter and the subsequent firestorm which continues to swirl around the case to this very day. Over the course of this compact but comprehensive conversation, we are going to explore Travis's story and life from a myriad of angles, spanning 1975 to 2013, and discuss the evolution of abductions, UFO research, and the media over that nearly 40-year time frame. Along the way, we'll venture down a myriad of side roads and explore some surprisingly unexpected realms. At long last, we conclude our marathon seventh season with an iconic and ironic player in the epic history of paranormal studies, talking about Travis Walton. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Travis Walton, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. On November 5, 1975, a group of loggers in the mountains of northeastern Arizona observed a strange, unusually bright light in the sky. One of those men, Travis Walton, recklessly left the safety of his truck to take a closer look. What happened next sent his companions fleeing in fear. When Travis failed to reappear, the men were suspected of murder. For 5 days, authorities mounted a massive manhunt in search of Walton or his body. He eventually reappeared, disoriented, and initially unable to tell the details of his terrifying encounter. His book, Fire in the Sky, provides an account of his experience. A major motion picture was also made with the same name. His website is www.travis-walton.com. Pretty simple, but don't forget the hyphen. Travis-walton.com. Check it out. And with all that said, my friends, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on June 24th, 2013. Travis Walton on the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7, and in keeping with the history of this program, we are closing out the season with a superstar of epic proportions in the world of the paranormal. Really, somebody who found himself at the crossroads of history, and really paranormal history. When the book on UFOs is written, they're going to need to dedicate a whole chapter to him, and if they do like an encyclopedia type, he's going to get his own book. That's how important his story is, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with it because he wrote a fantastic book that was turned into a film. We're talking about Fire in the Sky. He is Travis Walton, and it is a real thrill to have you on the program, somebody I've really wanted to talk to you for quite a long time. So welcome to the show, Travis, and I think it's going to be a fun conversation.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Now, as I was saying here in the introduction, you know, you found yourself here at the crossroads of paranormal history and really were a victim of circumstance. This wasn't something that, you know, that you did and then everyone was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You really were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or in the right place at the right time, I guess, for, you know, depending on perspectives, right? And really, you know, your whole life changed, your whole world changed. So generally, we start out with a bio and a background, but everybody really listening to this program is familiar with your story. And kind of what I was thinking here as I was getting ready to do the interview, putting myself in your shoes, really is just to ask, you know, to start out, do you ever get tired of rehashing this, reliving this? I mean, this thing almost happened 40 years ago. You ever like, oh, geez, I got to talk to this guy again about this thing that happened to me when I was 22, you know? Like, get over it. Do you feel like that to other people, that you just have to keep talking about it?
Well, you know, I try to live my life day to day and sort of box that up part of my life up and set it aside in my day-to-day life. So, you know, it's the interviews, you know, it used to be something that really just drained me to do it. But I've, you know, over the years become a little bit desensitized to the reliving the stress. But, you know, I guess my sense of purpose has changed over time, too.
How so?
Well, you know, back then it seemed more like I was just basically trying to defend myself and, you know, the reputations of the rest of the crew. But more and more lately, you know, along with the burden of all this, it you know, dawns on me that a sense of responsibility about trying to make something good come of it.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Well, you did have to spend a lot of the time, as you said, that was kind of the word that was floating around in my brain just then as you were talking, defend yourself. You know, you had to really make the case for it. Now, what good could come out of this? Just that people are aware that these things happen to people, I guess?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. And then part of it, you know, is that there's good cases and there's bad cases. And, you know, I never want to set myself up as judging the ones I don't think are good. But I think just by, you know, comparison that people make on their own, gradually I hope to kind of raise the bar, you know, kind of set a standard by which, you know, people can separate, you know, what are good and important cases, and there are many, and ones that aren't.
Well, that raises sort of an interesting point, because no pun intended, your story is a fascinating case study, in a sense. I mean, what happened to you was in 75, here we are almost 40 years later, and, I mean, you went through hell, your experience, returning, dealing with the humans, you know, forget the entities and the aliens, just dealing with the people on this planet when you got back was just insane. And nowadays, here in 2013, I mean, I don't know how much you go online or go on Facebook or whatever, but there are people who are like, you know, abductee and proud and you know, experiencers you know, it's like there's just tons of people who say that they have had these experiences. So it's an interesting, you know, contrast, I guess you could say, between what you went through and how, I guess, I don't know, perceptions have changed, you know, in the last 30 plus years.
Oh, yeah. You know, so much has changed over time. You know, in my case in particular, you know, a lot of the false allegations, you know, it took a while to you know, kind of tromp those down. But, you know, still, you'll still get people who are, you know, resurrecting old things that were disproved a long time ago. But in the field in general, there's been more of a trend towards acceptance. It's not as bizarre because, you know, for a variety of reasons. Space travel itself has become more of a norm, more of an accepted thing. In general, you know, shuttle missions are kind of routine. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, the whole world was glued to their TV set when there was a mission to the moon or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so the routineness of space travel plus reports from these space telescopes, you know, back when this happened, they didn't know of any planets outside of the solar system, for sure.
Right.
Of course, astronomers, you know, believed they existed, but they had no way of detecting them for sure. And now they have identified thousands and even a few hundred that are possibly Earth-like.
Right. That's an interesting sort of road to go down. When it came out that you had been abducted and everything, were you approached by other abductees, or was it such a rarity that, you know, there really weren't anybody else out there that could relate to your story?
Well, the hypnosis that I underwent was performed by Dr. James Harder, and he put me on the phone with Betty Hill. And although we didn't discuss incidents that much, you know, she talked a lot about the ability to, you know, handle the human reaction. And that was helpful.
Right. But aside from that, I mean, they weren't, like, coming out of the woodwork. Like nowadays, if somebody's abducted, there's support groups and all this other stuff.
Yeah, there's support groups. Well, there was nothing back then, you know. And, you know, even the psychiatrist that examined me said, this man is not lying, you know, but he's been through a traumatic event. But even he tried to explain it away in psychological terms, you know.
Yeah. Now,
and
I was
really,
okay,
really stretching the paradigm there because, you know, all the psychological explanations he came up with for me certainly wouldn't apply to six other crewmen who saw the same things.
Right, exactly. Well, that's why your case is really one of the signature cases in all of UFO history. I mean, the multitude of witnesses, and it's just a great case.
I get letters and email from people that express support, and that is helpful and it's a good thing. But at the same time, you wouldn't believe how many people, you know, probably one at each time I speak, who wants to get up and explain to me who they are, where they're from, what they meant, what their intentions were. And all that's well and good, except they're all different.
Right.
Every single one of them has the answer, and they're gonna fill me in. And I get a little bit annoyed about that, but
right. They're like, you know,
they can't all be true if they're all different.
yeah. They're saying they're in contact with someone, and you know, an entity or whatever, and they're sharing, you know. But they've been told what happened to you, essentially, what they're saying, kind of?
Well, I guess, you know, my insistence on trying not to draw conclusions or act like I know more than I do, it kind of leaves it's nature abhors a vacuum, you know, and there's an unanswered question there, and somebody wants to move forward and answer it. You know, for all I know, some of those people know what they're talking about, but how would I be able to tell who was... Which.
Exactly. You mentioned the hypnosis part. Obviously, I don't know how much you've been following the abduction field in the last few years, but hypnosis as a tool of abduction research has taken a huge hit. It's been really attacked in a lot of ways and really shown a lot of holes in it. And a friend of mine and I were sort of debating how much of your story is based on your own recollection versus the hypnosis regression. You know, if you could break it down sort of a, you know, 50-50.
Well, you know, hypnosis has always been attacked as a method, but then heck, some people do that with polygraph, because if the results don't jive with what they want to believe, then they're going to attack it. But you know, some of the criticism is justified, but whether it be polygraph or hypnosis, it's only as good as the operator, the investigator. And in my case, no real new information about what happened moment to moment. That really wasn't the point of the hypnosis. It was so traumatic and so, I would try to explain what happened and I'd just break down. The main goal there was to separate the recall from the fear. And it didn't bring any memories to me that I hadn't previously recalled, except that it did separate the fear to a certain extent. Of course, it was still there in a way, but I was at least able to, for the first time, relate to the investigators what happened.
Okay, so you remembered it all. It was really, but it was just so crazy or so traumatic that you couldn't even, you know, you couldn't get it all out.
And of course, you know, like the other kinds of explanations, like I was talking about the psychiatrist trying to come up with a psychological explanation, you know, the idea that I had a transitory psychosis. Of course, I had other psychiatric exams that were perfectly normal, and from a variety of different types of tests, and so that didn't back up the idea of a transitory psychosis. But the criticism of the hypnosis and also the drug hallucination theory, all three of these ways of trying to explain it away as some kind of a delusion that was induced in me by drugs or by the hypnotist or by some childhood psychological trauma, none of that pans out when you have to explain how seven people experienced a large part of this essentially the same detail.
Right. See, that's kind of, I guess, what the skeptics do. They just focus on don't worry about that. If we can just poke holes in his thing, we don't need to go after the other stuff, which is obviously.
It was kind of funny though to me that why you know, some people who were looking for some way to explain it away, you know, I'm talking about media people, in particular, would latch on to that as an explanation, never ask the question, well, how does this explain the others, what they witnessed? And it was.
Because they don't want to. They don't want to explain
that. Well, it's kind of a funny thing. The media loves to say, point, counterpoint. Hmm. You know, here's the pro, here's the con, and they want to have opposing points of view, and so they go out of their way to do that, even though it's silly on the face of it.
Hmm. Now, the only real, like, sort of part of your overall experience within the ship and all that that I really wanted to revisit is the whole aspect of how you saw this humanoid-type being on there. Because I have always found that really fascinating, and as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, that kind of gets askewed in some, obviously it was askewed in the movie. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's not mentioned,
you know,
at all. It's,
that is one aspect that, you know, people seem to go out of their way to just leave out, including the movie. But to me, it's maybe the key to the whole thing, you know, or it's certainly, you know, something you would think would really, you know, incite a lot of questions about, you know, the meaning of the whole thing.
Right, right. Now, I guess describe, I'm sure, you know, and going into this, I know you've done probably a million interviews, so I've really tried to tailor these questions at least, for the most part, you know, to stuff that maybe you haven't been asked
about. Well, these beings look so human that I took them to be human at first.
Mm.
And, you know, I've often said they would pass in American society without much notice.
But there was no communication between you and the humanoid or anything?
Well, yeah, it was definitely a one-way street. I was yelling all kinds of rather hysterical questions, but I didn't get any response.
And beyond it ignoring you, did it sort of behave like a human? Was it like, you know, was it physically like moving around like a human, or was it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, and you know, people will ask me, did it look like a robot? Did it look like an android? Did it look like it was, you know, in some kind of hypnotic trance or something? But no, you know, any entity that, you know, future technology could create that would function in place of a living organic being would probably be sophisticated enough to where you really wouldn't be able to tell. You'd have to have motions that were fluid and smooth and, you know, human-like. Otherwise, you know, it'd be useless.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't want to, like, I'm not trying to, like, poke holes in your story or anything. I'm just out.
No,
you know.
I understand.
Okay.
But, you know, these are all ideas that, you know, I've discussed in the book and
exactly.
Different times.
I know. Like I said, I try not to go over too much refresh ground, but it's almost impossible because you're such a star. So, and one of the big things that I find fascinating about this whole field of research is the field of research. As much as, you know, the phenomena is fascinating, it's, to me, it's how the human reaction to all this. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, what was your first impression of this UFO research community, you know, when this all unfolded, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, you went through a double trauma, really. I mean,
yeah. And, you know, I kind of discuss a little bit of that in the book. You know, there was quite a rivalry amongst the various investigative organizations. And I think a certain amount of that continues to this day. It's probably a little more congenial. But basically, even today, the good cases are the ones that particular investigator is looking at, and the ones that aren't so good are the ones somebody else is in charge of.
Exactly, yeah. Well, could you have, I mean, it sounds like really, you know, that it was a bit frustrating to deal with all these people. Could you have been, if you wanted to, aside from, I guess, the desire to prove or defend yourself, could you have just been like, you know what, like, leave me alone. This thing happened to me.
Yeah. You know, I really considered that option many times, you know. Given it a little further thought, it just was something I wasn't going to be able to do, but it really was tempting to just throw up my hands and say, fine, you know, just, you believe whatever you want to believe. I'm not going to talk to you about it anymore. It's your loss, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that would be, I think at some point I would get to that, you know?
Who knows? I may get there anyway, eventually.
Well, and again, to return to sort of this research community, it's interesting, and it's changed over the years, as we've talked about how abductees and experiencers and I guess you modern contactees too, you know, they're treated differently. But back then it was like, you know, you were evidence. You weren't a person. You were evidence for these people to pour over. And I mean, how did that feel? What was that like?
Well, you know, the bug in the jar thing, was really hard, and, you know, it wasn't just investigators, it wasn't just news media, you know, it's just walking around in public and getting the feeling that people were, you know, scrutinizing you just a little too closely, you know, just, you had to be careful not to be normal, because the way people act in a normal situation, if they were, you know, being micro-analyzed that way, is not going to look normal. So you have to be kind of guarded about how you appear in public, just to, you know, to be more normal than normal.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, so you know, their impression would be, oh, he's acting, you know, he's acting too normal. So it obviously didn't happen to him. That kind of thing.
Well, or you know, you just scratched your head wrong, and they say, oh, that was the weirdest thing. You know, it was we went roller skating. And it was my first time out, so I fell down a lot. But it was the weirdest thing. Travis, he'd fall down, and he'd get up, and he'd keep skating again. It was the strangest thing to hear somebody tell about it. There was 20 people on the floor doing the same thing, you know. But, you know, since it was me, it had to be weird. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, perfectly normal things have to be weird when you're under that kind of microscopic examination. But,
oh, God.
You know, the problem back then exists to this day with research. It's underfunded. You know, when something important happens, certain evidence is not going to sit around forever, and certain tests need to be done immediately, and a lot of that stuff is expensive. And there are some investigators who, you know, forge ahead and do their best, but it's so underfunded that a lot of opportunities are missed. And some of the better investigators are not all that recognized. They're kind of, toiling in obscurity, devoting a lot of their personal time and funding to try to, research these things.
Right, right. Well, the funding issue has been, that's a key problem with the whole UFO research community. It's a sad state of affairs. Now, Provided, it's kind of a difficult question to ask because, you know, technology's advanced so much, but provided you had the benefit of hindsight, when you returned from the abduction, is there something else you wish you had done, you know,
scientifically? Oh, yeah, there's lots of stuff. You know, there should have been follow-up things on the electromagnetic readings. There should have been follow-up readings on the radiation readings. My clothes, when I was returned, were carefully bagged for forensic analysis, and that got forgotten. They were thrown into the trunk and stuff, thrown in on top of it, the bag torn open, and so a lot of follow-up information was just went by the way because it wasn't acted on soon enough. And who knows what might have been discovered had a group of scientists been able to comb that site and look for traces that would no longer exist in a short period of time.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, the forensics of it all, like I said, the technology's changed so much. Like, if this happened today...
So, you know, some of the really well-known researchers are good, and some of the really well-known stars in ufology are not so good. And some of the really good ones are relatively unknown, and
sometimes there's a percentage break there between the amount of publicity they seek and the amount of quality work they produce.
Yeah.
So.
And I guess that kind of applies to the better cases, too, and the worst cases, you know. Some of the really famous cases are good, and some of them aren't, and some barely known ones are extremely good.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We just need more champions for those that aren't well known. Well, it's interesting. Not only were you in the middle of this UFO research circus, you were in the middle of this media circus. And at what point when you got back did you realize that this was all... that you were in the middle of an international story, you know, within a couple hours, within a day. I mean, obviously, you were messed up.
You know, I was coming away from a medical exam in which I went was on there under an assumed name because of the incredible interest, and we come out of the famous Barrows Neurological Institute after my brainwave scan, and we're in the parking lot, and somebody goes, "There he is!" And then they're chasing us, you know. So there was no way anybody at the hospital knew it was us. It was just because it was so much in the media. So it was almost immediate that the media intensity was just really something that took a lot of adjusting to.
How long, I guess it still continues to this day, but like how long was that?
I've learned a lot about the news media, and I think it really helps me when I watch the news. Mm-hmm. About, not about myself or any other cases in this area. I'm talking about just the news in general. I see the story behind the story because I know how they operate. And I think I see it through different eyes than, you know, the typical viewer.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Let's explore that a little bit. You know, we don't even need to use the dreaded three-letter word UFO. I mean, it seems like... You know, I guess this sort of thing's been going on since there was media, but it was kind of few and far between. And nowadays, it's like every month, there's like three or four people that get their 15 minutes of fame that explode, you know, as sort of micro celebrities. You know, I mean, what's your take on that? How the media's changed so much, and how do you feel about those people that experience that? Because you experienced it like 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to the accusation that news media is kind of becoming sort of tabloidish in their coverage. But people need to keep in mind always that the news media is not just performing some service to bring you the facts about what's going on in the world. That's the idealistic view. It's a business, and they're competitive. And so, you know, what brings the viewers in is what's going to rule the day.
So the more far out things are, even not even paranormal, even, you know, sometimes somebody does something weird and they're all of a sudden a viral starts. Strange. I'm sure you're probably kind of happy that this whole thing didn't happen to you like in the last few years, right?
I don't know, you know. I hadn't thought about that. Might be better, might be worse, who knows.
Yeah, well, like we said, I mean, you'd be able to get better
but
friends.
You know, if it happened nowadays, probably two or three crewmen at least would have had cell phone cameras, you know?
Exactly,
yeah. It changed everything.
Yeah, that's true. I never even thought of that, but yeah, it would have changed everything.
But, you know, I've talked to researchers in this field who actually think that these entities have sort of modified their behavior in terms of trying to keep a semi-low profile because of cell phones and, you know, everybody's got a camera in hand. And so had they continued with the kinds of behavior that they'd had in the past, there would have been some really undeniable footage by now. And so these entities are very highly technological, and they're able to, anticipate that.
I gotta say, that might be one of the most intriguing things I've heard in a long time, because that's a thought that has not crossed my mind.
Well, they've got to be at least as sophisticated as our own government.
Right, right.
And if if they can triangulate the position of every cell phone out there, certainly an advanced technology would be able to work around avoiding cameras. So.
And that's one of the big arguments you hear a lot nowadays. You know, people are like, well, everybody's got a phone with a camera on it. How come we don't have any better video? And it's like, like I said, I never considered what you said, but that makes perfect sense that, you know, they're always one step ahead of us, so it makes sense.
They would probably not only be able to know who had the camera, they would be able to detect if it was activated and probably be able to alter or
disarm
the image to a certain extent, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, Michio Kaku was given an interview a while back, and he said, you know, people continue to try to envision these advanced civilizations as being 100 or a few hundred years ahead of us, he said, but, you know, just the age of the universe and the age of these various systems, you know, you've got to consider that they could be hundreds of thousands or millions of years ahead of us. And so the technology, you know, is going to look like magic.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm blown away here by this line of thought, so thank you. What's it like nowadays when you go to these conferences? You said people talk to you, they want to tell you about, you know, their experience and how they've, you know, gone through all this. Do you find sort of that people, obviously they treat you differently, but they put you on a pedestal, let's say. I mean, does that make you feel uncomfortable to be sort of,
Oh yeah, I'm not comfortable with that at all because,
right.
You know, I'm just a person who, you know, what's special is what happened to us, not necessarily, you know, the people involved. But, by the same token, I've had to deal with the converse, people who think, some kind of lunatic, and that's not called for either. So I've kind of had to throw up barriers in both directions and just disregard the negative and the positive and try to, you know, with a certain circle of people, relate to them person to person, human to human, and never mind the celebrity or the, whatever, the negative aspersions.
Right, right. Well, that would be the frustrating part. I mean, I guess both sides of the coin are pretty frustrating, but, you know, it's like, why do you, like I said, I would, at some point I'd be like, I'm not going to argue about this with you anymore. It's enough's enough. Well, there's all this talk about disclosure, and people seem to think this is going to happen someday, or, you know, any day now if you talk to some people, and obviously that's been going on since the beginning of the UFO phenomenon. What's your overall thoughts on, you know, the possibility that we're going to get a breakthrough in all this, regardless of whether it comes from the government or from them, if you will?
Well, you know, in truth, it really could happen any day.
Yeah.
But probably the least likely scenario is the government saying, boy, there's popular demand for this out there. People really want this. I guess we'd better just come clean. I don't think that's going to happen. Because, you know, they've been lying for so long, to admit it now would really, you know, not be a good job security move for them. And so if it happens, it's going to be because a whistleblower runs away with the files or goes public, or some kind of an incident forces their hand.
Hmm.
There's a third possibility, and that's that if it serves their purpose to reveal it in some way, you know, it's part of a long-range plan they've considered for some time. I'm talking about our government.
Right.
That it serves their purpose to let us know now.
Now, there's always been a lot of talk about, you know, we don't have to focus really on Phil Klass, but, you know, sort of like the debunkers working for the government. I guess my overall point sort of here is, like, the government's stifling this subject. And did you ever feel sort of the heavy boot of, you know, the bureaucracy on you with regards to your story?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, what's really strange is how it focused more on the rest of the crew than on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Phil Klass never made any kind of attempt to contact me, write me a letter, a phone call, or anything. And you would think that, you know, he could, you know, do his normal thing, you know, talk to me, and then chop up the interview and distort what I said, and, you know, or something like that. But he never attempted that at all, and that's very odd to me. And I really do think, you know, I have to revisit the idea that he had a little urging from behind the scenes.
Mm.
Especially in light of the Freedom of Information Act stuff.
That's what I was alluding to. Yeah. Yeah. It seems that it's sort of been borne out a little bit, the theories that he was,
he was being investigated for revealing classified information in connection with his job, but they decided not to prosecute. And I have the memo where J. Edgar Hoover turns it over to the director of the CIA. And so, you know, it's really easy to hold that kind of threat of prosecution over somebody's head and sort of guide their behavior in the future. And
interesting. So that predated his campaign against UFOs, if you will?
Yeah.
Interesting. See, I never really explored that part of it all, so.
Yeah, it's all there in his FBI file. But there was also other things that came to us you know, harassment from the government to Mike, the crew boss, and to Steve Pierce, the youngest guy on the crew. The extreme amount of effort that was put into trying to bribe Steve to deny it. You know, $10,000 is not anything that you would think the author of anti-UFO books could come up with that easily. But even though I criticized him for being an armchair investigator and doing all of his so-called investigations on the phone, I found out later that he actually flew to Texas, took Steve out to dinner, and tried to get him to accept this bribe. I found out that he flew to Phoenix and had somebody drive him up to the site. And it's really weird that he would not mention this in his extensive writings about this case.
Mm.
It's very peculiar. And again, how can you afford that kind of travel on the meager sales of his anti-UFO books?
Right, right. What do you...
A lot of circumstantial kinds of things all pointing in the same direction. You know, I kind of leaned away from that theory, and I just basically, you know, figured it was his own fanaticism for the most part. But now I'm much more heavily that he, you know, had some bankroll.
Right, right. It seems that way, you know, because he was all over the place, and I'm not sure exactly what he did for a living off the top of my head, but, you know, he sort of seemed to travel.
He was a magazine editor, but I wouldn't think that would...
You're right, yeah. He wasn't he wasn't like a Hollywood actor or a sports star with the money to fly.
Not a magazine that has very large circulation at all.
Now, what do you think he visited the location for? You sort of alluded to the fanaticism part. Do you think he was trying to look for something that could help his case to debunk, or do you think
he's
one?
You know,
and he couldn't really find
it. Who knows? He. I wouldn't put it past him to try to deposit false evidence on the location, but nothing like that ever came about. So, you know, it's just the fact that he went there and didn't say he had been there. In face of the criticism that he hadn't done so, is weird.
It certainly is. Like maybe it suggests to me that he was looking for something and couldn't find. Even if it was like a, you know, like a scenario he could paint to, like you said, to plant the false evidence. You know, maybe just a shade below that. You know, he's looking for something that he could tie it all in. And since he didn't, it didn't help his case to mention that he went there, I guess.
Unless he secretly believed it and was looking for other kinds of evidence.
Yeah, that thought did cross my mind as we were talking about it. Also, yeah, that is the possibility that you know, maybe he was doing double duty. Maybe he was doing the debunking for the government and doing the investigating for the government, you know?
Yeah.
He came back and said, okay, here's the, you know, here's how it all stacks up from the scene. Now, I guess I'm sure this has been explored in other places, and I heard a couple of the guys from the crew on with you on Coast to Coast, but what was the relationship with you and these guys, you know, in the immediate aftermath, and then how it all shook out over the last few decades?
Well, you know, the crew, you know, they're constantly being referred to as my buddies or my friends, you know, but we were just a group of men that would come together in the morning to go to work, and then when we went home, we generally didn't hang out with each other that much. Maybe, you know, two here, two there, like that kind of.
Right.
As a group, there was no cohesiveness amongst the seven. And once the job broke up, you know, that became even more, you know, or I should say less connected. But so all these years, one of the crewmen was, we hadn't heard from him. I hadn't heard from him since. I spoke to him just about the time the movie came out, and then in the 20 years since then, nobody had heard anything from him. But I had a police officer friend look into it and finally located him just last week. So.
Oh, wow. Are you going to reach out to him, or are you just going to kind of let it go to see if he, you know?
I'm going to reach out, but I'm going to let him get acclimated first. He's not quite ready to speak publicly, but he says he's willing to. But he remembers a lot of stuff that night that I think is important to get on record because, you know, everybody's looking in different directions. Everybody's thinking different things and seeing different things. So it helps fill out the picture to finally find him and get his recollections.
Right, right. Because he might remember something that the other guys don't. You know, he may have an extra piece to the puzzle that we haven't heard yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. So there wasn't any animosity or anything like that, did they?
No, no. And I spoke to him for about 25 minutes. And he has been an electrician journeyman for years. And he likened the sound that the beam made when it hit me as being like high voltage. You know, he's worked around industrial power sources, and when they throw the switch on those big things, that sound of that surge of energy is what that reminded him of. And so I thought that was significant.
Yeah.
When I spoke at engineering school in Rapid City, the questions the students were asking were they were very curious about the sounds. And so, you know, you can kind of, you know, draw some conclusions if you have a little technical background from things that the rest of us might just say, well, you know, it sounded kind of like this. And, you know, it was just a weird sound. But to them, they can correlate that to particular energies and effects.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, we need more experts looking at this, regardless of their, you know, vocation, if you will. So did you, I guess there, you seem like such a laid back guy. I mean, I don't know what it was like going through all of it then, but were you sort of, I mean, just to stay on the crew aspect of it, were you so, and you mentioned how, you know, no one ever really mentions that they all saw the thing, or no one wants to really revisit that part of it. Was there any sort of like, oh shit, man, why couldn't it have been you or the other guy? Was it, you know, was there sort of like that feeling, or were they ever sort of like, you know, oh man, this guy's, you know, despite all the media frenzy and everything, this guy's a celebrity. Was anyone ever sort of like, oh, I wish that happened to me, you know, or anything like that?
Yeah, I think there probably is a few of them that eventually came to that feeling, but at the same time, there was so much negative that, you know, I broke trail for them over the years, so they're all willing to speak now, but it was a lot tougher way back.
Hmm.
And some of them relate stories of being present where somebody is claiming that they were on that crew or knew those guys, the crew members, intimately. And here's a crew member standing right there listening to the story, and they just keep their mouth shut. So, you know, you can see that even people who had nothing to do with it want to claim that they were involved in it in some important way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, it was, you know, in the grand.
I have a friend that, you know, not a real good friend, but, you know, he is now, he thinks. But, you know, he tells the story that when I was returned and I came to the phone booth, the first person I called was him. And then I called my family. Well, you know, the operator listened in on the phone call. All that stuff was traced, and there was only one phone call from me to my family for help. And so, but even though he's a supporter, you know, he wants to say that, you know, I was, the first thing I did was call him. And there's somebody else that I went to high school with that, you know, I don't remember him that well, but they're claiming that they went to that homecoming party that we had when I was returned. Well, you know, that was a story device in the movie, and that party never really happened. But these are the kinds of stories that people tell in order to, you know, situate themselves more centrally to the story.
Right, right. Well, these are people, like, in the area where you live still, right?
Right.
Yeah. I can see kind of how, in some strange way, it's a point of civic pride, in a way. I can see how people
would
want to be.
Yeah, well, it's not all positive. Some of it's negative. You know, this one guy's claiming that he was the sheriff's nephew, and he had the inside story on it. And he tells this whole story about how when the crew came into town that they met with the sheriff at the Red Robin Diner. And he goes into all the details of what was said there, but the Red Robin Diner didn't exist for another 20 years after that. And so when people questioned him about that. He goes, I meant the red onion. And there is a red onion in Heber, but that also wasn't there for another 20 years. But, you know, it's just a way of trying to say they have an important part of it, the story to tell.
Right.
You know, everything the guy was saying was just totally bogus. For one thing, he wasn't the sheriff's nephew. The relations that he's talking about is the town marshal. And the town marshal really didn't have that big of a role in the investigation. The county sheriff is a completely different family.
Yeah.
So,
well,
all kinds of stories.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like that. Is there in the area now, it seems like all these events, you know, they have a McMinnville event, they have an Exeter event, obviously they have a Roswell event. Do they ever do anything to commemorate your event, or is it such a sort of traumatic and unpleasant story that they shy away from it?
Well, the local Chamber of Commerce type regional development people came to me and wanted to do a Roswell or McMinnville type thing, and I shied away from that, and I haven't done any kind of talks or anything locally, but I've kind of shifted my feeling on that in recent times, and I was approached recently about doing a talk here. So I'm going to do one here next month and see how that goes. I may regret it. I still kind of have mixed feelings about it, but it's something they wanted to do, so they're putting it together all.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?